Sydney is peppered with places that will make the hair on the back of your neck stand on end, from mass graves and mental asylums to the haunted hallways of historic convict prisons. You're going to have to prepare for the darkness of Sydney, Australia. I'm Rishu Sheth, and this is Legend. Darlinghurst Gaol began construction in 1822 and was opened in 1841 to replace the aging and overcrowded Sydney Gaol on George Street near Circular Quay. It took 50 years to complete, with new buildings being added to accommodate the increasing population over the following decades. Aboriginal people were among the many prisoners incarcerated at the jail until it closed in 1914, by which time all prisoners had been transferred to the new men's and women's prisons at Long Bay. As a main Sydney goal for the second half of the 19th century, it housed everyone from murderers to those who could not pay their fines for petty offenses such as drunkenness. The gaol set on the ridge between Woolloomooloo and Rushcutters Bay. Aboriginal people lived nearby while the gaol was in operation, including at Bardcombe Glen just below the gaol until the 1860s, and elsewhere around Rushcutters Bay until around 1900. While some were inmates at Darlinghurst, usually for minor offenses, most Aboriginal prisoners came from elsewhere across NSW. Sydney was the heart of the colonial justice system, and Darlinghurst Gaol came into operation when colonial expansion across the state was underway. Aboriginal people were arrested for offenses such as assaults, murders, and spearing cattle on the colonial frontier, and for a range of other crimes as they tried to adjust to life under colonial rule. The poor conditions in the gaol contributed to the health of prisoners, which was very ill health, and some of the Aboriginal inmates died. There is an awareness that Aboriginal people were more susceptible to illness and also depression while incarcerated, though it rarely led to any preventive action. For example, Dickey, whose 1864 death sentence was commuted to a life sentence, was transferred to the Parramatta Lunatic Asylum from Darlinghurst Gaol in 1868. He was returned to jail in 1869 and died of influenza in the jail hospital in 1872. Some Aboriginal prisoners received training in the stonemasonry in the 1850s and 1860s. In 1876, several skilled Aboriginal weavers at the jail had their mats displayed at the Centennial International Exhibition in Philadelphia. It is not known exactly how many Aboriginal prisoners were there at Darlinghurst Gaol, as their Aboriginality was not always noted in admission registers, particularly in cases of mixed ancestry. Prison photos and records are sometimes the only historical evidence we have of the Aboriginal people, and historians are now beginning to examine these records in more detail to reclaim the lives of the Aboriginal prisoners from the archives. The available statistics do not suggest, though, that Aboriginal prisoners were as overrepresented in the prison system as in more recent times. In 1879, for example, between 1 and 3% of all prisoners were black or colored, which included a range of non-Aboriginal people. Aboriginal offenders in NSW were sentenced to anything from several days to years to life in prison, and at least two were among the 79 prisoners executed at the jail. One of those to hang was the most notorious Aboriginal inmate at Darlinghurst Gaol, Jimmy Governor, 1875 to 1901, RIP. In July 1900, Governor, his brother Joe, and their friend Jackie Underwood murdered a family at Breelong, for Wom Jimmy had been working with. Okay, maybe not RIP. Anyway, they went on the run, killing several more people and were subject to the biggest manhunt in Australian history. Jimmy was caught several months later at Wingham, near Taree, and was brought to Sydney for trial, where he was found guilty and sentenced to death in November 1900. He spent his final weeks at Darlinghurst Gaol, where his fluctuating daily moods and discussions with gaol guards were meticulously recorded in a macabre diary up until several days before his execution by hanging in the jail on the 18th of January 1901. Since the closure of the gaol in 1914, the building has been used for a very different purpose. For most of the past century, it has been home to the National Arts School, which has numbered an Aboriginal people among its many students. So at least it can do some good, even if it has a dark past. Ah, Studley Park. Said to be haunted by 14-year-old Ray Blackstone, who drowned in a nearby dam on the 15th of October, 1909. His lifeless body has said to have been carried back to the house and kept in the cellar awaiting certification and burial. In 1939, the son of then-owner Arthur Adolphus Gregory died of appendicitis in the theaterette. Again, a boy's body lay in this house. It is said that the presence of children can be felt throughout the house, but in the tower stands a lonely woman waiting for the return of her man. Here's some history. The Studley Park property has a history that goes back 200 years. Governor Lachlan Macquarie granted the property as two parcels of 100 acres each to John Condren and William Parrott in 1810. After several changes in ownership, it was purchased as a one parcel by W.C. Payne in 1888, the one about building Studley Park House, so named after Studley Park near Ripon in Yorkshire, England. In 1891, Payne was obliged to sell the property to Francis Buckle, the architect of the house, to cover his debts. In 1902, the property became the Camden Grammar School after it was sold to Dr. Henry Oliver. The property continued its life as a school until 1933, when the school closed and it was sold for $4,900 to Arthur Gregory. By the way, I don't know if the $4,900 is Australian dollars or US dollars. Do your research, I don't know. Anyway, Arthur Gregory, sales manager of 20th Century Fox, who went about refurbishing the house in the Art Deco style. Gregory was a keen golfer and commissioned Eric Apperley to design a 9-hole course for Studley Park, with further 9 holes were later designed. The property was acquired by the Army during World War II for $16,000 and used as a school or tactical instruction. One of its first students was Lieutenant, I don't know what I'm saying. I'm just going to say Lieutenant, there we go. Lieutenant A.R. Cutler, who later became the governor of NSW. The end of the war saw a decline in the use of Studley Park, and in 1951, the newly formed WRAC moved in to start their training under WO2 Patricia Rawlings. From the 1930s to 1950, golf was played at several venues within the Camden area. In 1949, a group of residents approached the Army and secured a 10-year lease on all but 18 acres containing Studley Park House and its surrounds for use as a golf club, and so Camden Golf Club was established in 1950 at its permanent site at Studley Park. The stables were later converted for use as the clubhouse. In 1958, major extensions were added to the clubhouse, and further work was completed in 1973. In 1975, Studley Park House was surplus to the Army's requirements, but it was not until 1984 that negotiations commenced, bringing Studley Park House under the control of Camden Golf Club or into public ownership. This resulted in Charles Naughton and Gabriel Olson purchasing Studley Park House in 1989, who in turn left it vacant in 1994. The lease was extended several times, and in 1992, the federal government agreed to sell the land to Camden Golf Club on a 99-year lease. In 1995, the lease was finally signed. Camden Golf Club purchased Studley Park House and Lot 1 in 1996, thereby bringing the entire property under its control. Studley Park House celebrated their 50th anniversary in the year 2000. So this year, it's actually its 70th anniversary, if you're listening in 2020. But it is an anniversary of tragedy and darkness. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Legend. There's a new episode every Monday, so stay tuned for that. And as always, thanks for listening.